der Digital Insurance Podcast. Seit 2020 die Nummer 1 für Strategie und Innovation in der Versicherungswirtschaft. Und ich bin Jonas Pieler.
What's the latest in data analytics and how can I leverage AI to extract more insights from my data warehouse? I'm today discussing this and more with Conor Jensen, America's field CDO at DataIQ. Welcome to the show, Conor.
Yeah, thank you, Jonas. So excited to be here.
Please briefly explain who DataIQ is and what you guys are doing.
So DataIQ is a 10-year-old technology startup. We are essentially a workbench for developing analytics across all of your data. And so that's sort of, and using any type of analytics. So we've been focused primarily in the data science space as a starting point, but we sort of support doing BI all the way to advanced analytics through to the latest and craziest generative AI trends.
But how do you pronounce DataIQ? Is it DataIQ or is it DataIQ?
So there's a lot of different pronunciations, especially since we're such a global company. But the word itself is a portmanteau, so a mashup of data and haiku, right? And haiku is a Japanese poem, for those aren't familiar with it. So that's the biggest is in the US, you tend to hear DataIQ as sort of four different syllables. And the French tend to say it DataIQ, since that's
okay.
How they pronounce data. So I will say I've probably heard 100 different pronunciations of it over the years and it all works, but I always personally say DataIQ.
DataIQ. Okay, so I'm going to stick with DataIQ. Okay. So your role is, and you might probably explain your role quite a bit, CDO at DataIQ, what's that?
So a little bit of background probably helps that. So I actually met DataIQ 7 years ago during a POC when I was in the insurance space working for the North American wing at Zurich Insurance. And I was leading our data science platform development as part of our data science group and leading where we were building out a new architecture for leveraging all of our data for the data scientists. That sort of is most of my background. I've been in data and analytics across a number of different industries. So I worked in the US Air Force as a meteorologist starting about 20 something years ago. Went back to school, studied maths, ended up in insurance. I was in retail for a little while working for Starbucks, then ended up in insurance in the sort of actuarial space and moved into data science. And I've spent most of my career sort of either using analytics to do my job, right? Like when I was a weather forecaster, I wasn't writing models, but we certainly used sophisticated analytics and tools to develop our products, or building models or building now teams and platforms and everything. And so I've sort of seen all the different sides of what analytics can mean for a company, both as a consumer and as a producer of them. And that's really what my role here as a field CDO is. And so we work with our customers or potential customers to help them less from a technology perspective and more from a strategic perspective. How are they integrating analytics? How are they integrating AI into their business? And we help with sort of that plan and that. And it all comes, we're all sort of former data executives. And so we sort of bring our experience into that.
So in the last 12 months and probably in other industries, what setup of data analytics has impressed you most?
That's a good question. You know, so I think that the obvious answer, you can't ignore the generative AI
right.
And the large language models. You know, while I'm always dubious of hype and waiting to see that move out, especially in the corporate space, right? So it's one thing from a tech and a Silicon Valley perspective, but I'm waiting for that to really manifest itself in sort of like real corporate impact. Mm-hmm. So I'm impressed by the technology.
Right.
But I would actually, if I sort of say like the wow moment for me was I was speaking with a customer in the States here who's actually in the manufacturing sector. It's a company called Oshkosh Corporation. They make like commercial and military trucks, so like big heavy duty vehicles. And I was speaking with them a little while ago and they're a relatively new customer for us and still relatively new on their sort of AI journey. But really in the conversation, they said, you know, in the last 18 months, they'd gone from doing the majority of their analytics either in Excel for sort of your typical analyst and that, or they had some data scientists who were doing things with sort of notebooks and Python and very manual processes. And in 18 months, they went from everything being manual and hard to do to deploying models like on their trucks that were like running in like local, yeah. So like edge computing and everything. That was the thing that was most impressive to me. And it wasn't necessarily that any of the use cases that they were doing were mind-blowing. They were very like fleet management and predictive maintenance and things that are sort of fairly sort of typical use cases for the manufacturing sector. But in 18 months, they'd gone from very manual, hard to do, to hundreds and thousands of models deployed, like on their trucks, monitored in real time, all sorts of stuff. That speed of change, that was the one of the most impressive things I've heard in a while.
How many people are there?
So a total company or from a...
Yeah, like the entire people that were sort of affected of this. Like, I mean, what I'm trying to get at is large companies usually take longer to implement big changes than smaller companies,
sure,
but because they're moving bigger organizations, and once they have done that, they have moved the big needle in bigger ways.
Sure. So Oshkosh is a mid-sized company. So I'd say probably in the like tens of thousands of people
at
most.
Which is pretty large though for an insurance company in Germany, right?
It's not 100 people, right? Yeah. I guess is probably good. So, you know, the thing that was, I guess, also impressed about them was that it wasn't that it was one team. It wasn't like one unit that moved really far. This was people from different manufacturing parts of the business, also people from their finance team, also people from their like operations teams internally. And so it wasn't like one part of the business suddenly really like moved the ball ahead. It was a lot of parts of the business moved together sort of in synchrony. And that was, I think, additionally impressive, not just the speed, but that it was on many fronts.
Do you know how they did it, just like in a brief sense? Like the top three success factors, if you will, like in bite size.
So the top three things that I would say from, you know, what they've said, the first one was that it was a very clear joint effort and that it was driven by the business,
right,
rather than being driven by IT. And so it was sort of the people in the business units who were trying to do it, but they were sort of like all on board with it.
So it was sort of driven by a need, right, versus by a solution.
Yes, it was absolutely, here's a problem that we're trying to solve. What do our customers need? And it was very customer focused as well. And I think that that puts a different level of urgency on it when you're like, okay, this is a thing that will help our customers. The other thing that they were very smart about was that they played like, it's a push and pull, like ROI or cost benefit analysis for data science can be really tricky, right? Because the models, the build, or, you know, when you build your architecture, when you're investing in the technology is a means to an end. And it's hard to sort of say, oh, well, we're going to build this platform that everybody in our company can use. Well, what's the ROI for that guy over there? And that can be a really tricky sort of thing when it's an enabling technology that allows everybody to do, or many people to do new
because
things.
It always kind of implies by how much is someone getting more efficient. And this is something is hard to quantify, right?
They're doing what they already did, right? They're just doing it better.
Right.
And maybe it's faster.
How do you quantify
maybe it's better.
That?
How do you quantify it? It's very, very hard. And even if you say, well, it took us, you know, to be fair, when data science teams move onto our platform, you know, we see on average about a like 4 to 5x increase in productivity. And so
how do you measure that then?
Like number of projects that they can produce over a given period of time, right? So, or like data products or data projects, that tends to be what we hear. And so
what's a data project? I think we got to explain that quickly.
Fair enough. You know, I sort of think about it as in the same way that a sort of software product or a data product, it's a specific element built to solve a specific problem. And so it can be different things. And that's one of the things this is challenging in this analytics world is it could be a new dashboard. That could be the data product. But it could be a new pricing model sitting behind your sort of customer-facing side. It could be like a new chat interface for your customers, right? So it's a wide range, but it's sort of an application or a product that you've produced to solve some sort of problem. And the problems are sort of, there's an endless list of things you can do with those.
Okay, we got to get back to this top three list, what that did besides in a second, but just for me to understand, because a hardware product would be a physical computer, for example, or a smartphone, something you can touch. It consists of metal, electronics, screen, whatever.
Yeah.
A software product, on the other hand, is something you can see on a screen, which is interfaces, buttons, text, graphics, whatever. And the data product is essentially numbers or
algorithms.
I wouldn't say reform metadata, but in a generative AI world, it would be sort of recalculated data, kind of remixed or recompositioned.
Like augmented maybe, right? Like augmented
exactly.
or improved, yeah.
And this is independent of the context in which you display this. You could be displaying this in a dashboard. You could be displaying this in an API that is providing data to some third product, whatever. You could be displaying this in a chat interface. And this is just kind of, well, I mean, the data behind it just kind of explains it, but doesn't explain it at the same time.
Yeah.
But I think this kind of describes it easiest for users, right? Or here, listeners.
This is the same challenge that I had in the insurance space when people were like, well, what is a product? And I'm right. like, well, it's a piece of paper, sort of.
But yeah, exactly. Right? In the insurance world, exactly.
It's this a little intangible.
That's why we always call these things digital services
sure.
versus digital products, because the product is the policy or the insurance mm-hmm. plan. And the digital product, a digital service is sort of something accompanying this insurance product by means of digital interfaces and so forth. And then you have this digital data product kind of thing that's kind of adding another layer, right?
And one nuance there, and I know we want to get back to the top exactly. three, so I'm not going to forget that. The one nuance there that has actually been important to me over the last couple of years of moving from calling them like data projects, which is how we typically would refer to them, to data products, is that the development of these applications or services is much more like product management than it is like project management. And so
a project is a means to an end, right?
And it's sort of starts and stops.
Exactly.
And when you're done, it's done and you walk away. And when you've built a new model or you've built a new data, right? There's always new data. There's always new applications. There's always new things that need to be refined. And so moving into a product management mindset when it comes to, and I'd say this is true in both the digital world and the data world, right? I mean, where there's a lot of overlap, but thinking about them as products, even if there's a reason to call them services or something so that you're not confusing with the insurance products, there's a lot of value in that mindset, because I think it can be hard for especially a more traditional IT team that's used to sort of IT project management. Data project management or product management is substantially different. And I don't think that we have that all the way ironed out yet.
I think this is super important. I think we need to reiterate on that.
Okay.
This is so important because what you're saying is in the past, we have been doing IT projects, which have a start and an end. And usually in the end, there was some sort of artifact produced, new application, whatever.
Here's a new system, here's a new
exactly.
service.
And then
well. Yep.
The team dissolves into the wider organization, disappears. And whatever has been produced is sitting there, hopefully running like a machine would be running in your workshop. But unfortunately, the world keeps turning and new developments happening. And that's why in this digital services world or this application development world, people are now shifting, and in other parts have already shifted, but insurance companies are already shifting right now to a process-based model where you not only have like this project and then it kind of sits there waiting to be used. You have a process where constantly improvements are being applied to whatever product you have. You have someone, and this is, I think, the important thing. You have someone responsible for this digital application. Mm. And this is the same logic or mindset you need to have for these data
yes.
artifacts, where you have someone responsible for this model or set of data or analytics or generative AI model or something that sort of that looks at, okay, are we still producing the good results like we have done yesterday?
Mm-hmm.
Can we improve our results? Have maybe the requirements for our results changed over time because we need to give a different answer today or tomorrow? And this type of responsibility some person or team needs to take is something that I think you have just emphasized is the big mindset change, right?
And I think an important thing to add here, especially in the data space, and when we start not just thinking about sort of tracking data, but when we start thinking about now data science, whether actuarial science or data science and predictive modeling or however, is that the way I always sort of think about this is, you know, at its core, actuarial science or data science is a statistical model that's trying to predict something, but it's a map of sort of the underlying world based on the data. And the world changes. And so when you think about creating these data products, it's as good as it gets the day that it goes out, but then the world's going to keep shifting underneath it. And so you have to, unlike that sort of that piece of code or that artifact or that system that you've built that you put out there and it just runs. And then as long as, you know, at some point you'll change something else and it'll break.
Yeah.
Like a model gets stale and the data no longer works. And so, you know, think about this. I mean, it's very common in the insurance space of like, why would we update pricing models every year? Why do we update our reservings, right? Because think about auto insurance, right? Like the landscape of what it looks like to fix a car 10 years ago to today with computers and electronics, and like the cost model has shifted
and
where you have to pay and things. And so if we're using pricing models from 10 years ago, you'd be hopeless in that. Plus, there's new cars that exist today that didn't even exist 10 years ago. So you can't just use old things. But that's true across all the data science, whether you're looking at homeowners and personal insurance or you're looking at the corporate space. You know, like the world changes and our models have to change with them. And you can't just leave them out there to, you know, get stale and be inaccurate.
So these are the two big things this company we've just talked about has done, which is kind of have the mindset and kind of this need and this global goal and this unified vision behind it, plus this mindset change where they are thinking about data products as process instead of project, which is finished, right?
Yes.
Is there anything third that's worth mentioning? After, I mean, these are two big things. So
these are two big things.
Right? Is there a third one that kind of can have the same level of impact or importance, or can take it up with the first two ones?
The third that I think that they did really well, and I sort of started a little bit on this, was they, while they didn't require too much sort of pre-work on saying, oh, we're going to build this system and here's the benefit we're going to get out of it, they are smart about how they're tracking things on the back end. And so they were able to say, hey, we developed this model that is a new ad and it generated $10 million in revenue. And they put the pieces in place before they worked on a project. They didn't necessarily say, will we see an ROI out of it? We don't know yet. We're not sure. But they did understand how they were going to track the ROI.
Okay.
And that was an important thing, right? It's an important distinction. You don't necessarily know every data science project is going to be successful.
Like, is it like startups, like 9 out of 10 fail?
Well, hopefully the your data initiatives are a better, although, I mean, there's...
With innovation, that's always, right?
Yes,
with exactly everything right. You try, when you're trying new stuff that hasn't been done before, 9 out of 10 things fail.
Some things don't work. And, you know, you should shoot for better than that in a data science, you know, initiative. But if everything is working, then you're shooting too low.
Right.
You're not trying hard enough. And the other thing, especially when you start actually doing the modeling side, is, you know, in statistics, the null result is an actually valuable result. So you may try to build a model for something and just be able to say, you know what, we can't predict this with the data that we have, but that's information for you, right? You know, from a risk perspective, if you're trying to find new metrics to help you, you know, understand a risk profile better, and the data doesn't tell you that, like, you should be thinking really carefully about how you're going to insure that product then.
Right.
Or should you be writing that product, right? Like, there are tricky things in there. And if we don't have the right data to understand something, like, then our understanding of the risk is lower than the risk itself, then we're taking on a lot more risk than we used to. So, like, not getting an answer is actually should inform us something and isn't a failure. But yes, hopefully it's not 9 out of 10 times that they're failing.
So this is sort of what data-first companies look like. Is it right?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's a very hard aspiration to move towards because it requires everybody to be part of that movement. And I mean everybody, like your executives, your workers, your frontline people who are putting data into the systems. Everybody has to sort of understand and be willing to not only help make sure there's good data, but be data-driven in their decision-making and question the data and question the decisions they're making.
I've got so many questions here on my list. And we already spent like 20 minutes talking, so I don't know what to choose next, to be honest. So you can decide. Either we talk about privacy conversation in the US because Apple is betting big on privacy first, or we talk about the state of data analytics in insurance companies in US and DACH. What do you prefer?
Let's talk about the privacy one.
Right.
I think it's an interesting one to spend a little bit of time on, right?
Yeah, go ahead.
And to be fair, you know, the sort of privacy and responsible AI is not my sort of first and foremost area of expertise, but yeah, having run a data science team in an insurance company, I used to have a weekly meeting with our chief privacy officer. So, you know, it's not a new concept
to me. You have some expertise by way of doing it, right?
The privacy concerns is an interesting challenge one. And I'll look at it from a couple aspects. Is one, there's a push, right? So removing Google taking cookies out and Apple dieting down on privacy. Like there is a push from the tech companies who've already made their trillions of dollars from your data to not let everybody else have it anymore.
Interesting perspective.
I think that it's self-serving, honestly, in why they're doing that, because that's how they became who they are, is with your data. And now they don't want to let anybody else have it.
I have another cynical view on data privacy. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, at some point, it's like climate change. It's great unless it kind of touches your own life.
Yes.
If you have to stop flying planes, taking flights, if you have to stop driving your big, awesome car, and if you have to stop using your whatever WhatsApp's chat message app, mm-hmm. suddenly privacy and climate gets less important.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't touch you, oh, you're all for it, right?
Yes.
And I have the feeling this is sort of a cynical view on this, but...
I agree with where you're going with that. And that was, you know, similar to what I'm thinking is there's a couple things here. One is that I think as a society, I hope that, and as governments move better into this sort of regulation side of things, we start being able to help people retain the value of their data a little bit more, right? I think that that's an important move that we need to make. But as long as we leave it up to tech companies to decide how data gets used, like that's never going to happen because that's how they're going to make their money. And so things like the GDPR and the CC California, I never remember the acronym, the California one, whatever the acronym is. GDPR is so much easier to remember. They're helping.
Unless you have to use the German abbreviation in German, which I always forget, but GDPR is much easier.
Okay.
Sorry. All right. Keep going.
No. I think there's a couple things that we have to think about. And one, data privacy is actually really, really hard. So think about like a set where you're masking people's information, where anything that's personally identifying gets removed from the data set.
Which is it's personally identifying is a vague term because...
It's a vague term.
If you combine everything, eventually everything becomes identifiable.
And that's exactly how it happens, right? So like a good data scientist can go into a handful of systems where sort of all that has been able to be taken out and go look at one result and be able to go back to the original system and sort of say, nope, I can trace what has happened here and uncover. That's true like 90% of the time, you know, is that despite sort of the things that we put in place to protect people, bad actors, if they want to, can usually go back and figure out where that person came from. And as the data multiplies, it becomes that much easier, right? And so it's important for companies to be mindful of how they're using the data and to do what they can to keep that data secure. But I think that there's a certain amount of, unless we fundamentally change how we interact with the internet or digital products or anything.
How do you strike this balance? Because this is the key thing, because companies need to understand, okay, how do I balance these different interests and how do I make sure that the data I have to use, because guess what? I have to use it in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
How do I make sure that I don't use too much of it? How do you strike this balance? Yeah, it's hard.
So the way that we typically would do this is start from the problem I'm trying to solve and say, here's whatever, it's a risk model we're building or it's a claims model building, whatever. And we say, this is the problem. This is the business problem we're trying to solve. What data do we have available for doing this? And we would sit down with the compliance and the privacy team and say, okay, this is a problem we're trying to solve. These are the data sources that we have available. What data in here should we not be using? But we did it up front. So it wasn't, we built a model. And so we learned this the hard way, to be fair, right? This is, you know, some of my predecessors had come in, they built a model. And at the end, they went to the privacy team and said, we're going to use this model. And the privacy team was like, oh, hell no, right? Like, so like, it helps to front load this effort, but you have to bring those people into the loop from the beginning.
Right.
And then it just has to be sort of a constant. And that's, you know, why I had that weekly one-on-one with our chief privacy officer was to talk through, he and I met and talked about all the projects and made sure that we were sort of like all on the same page. Every time we'd start a new project, we brought them in. And so you have to get the input of those people as early as possible, the people that are the naysayers and the people that are going to be cautious. And then you just work through it and you do the best you can. So it's not a perfect answer, but that's, you know, I think that starting it at the early is the best.
I get it. We got to touch on what I promised in my intro statement, which is how can I leverage AI to extract more insights from my data warehouse? So we understand data warehouses. We understand data analytics and kind of displaying data and then la, 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 la. So how do I use AI to improve this? And what can I actually get with AI that I couldn't have gotten without it?
I'd say there's maybe sort of like two or three major categories here that we're going to think through. The first one is the ability to combine data from multiple sources in tools where you can leverage AI across your data sources. And this is, it's not necessarily AI, but it's the foundational piece of being able to say, hey, I've got a data warehouse about customers in, you know, one product line and another product line and another product line. And I need to be able to look at sort of profiles across those. I mean, A, obviously for cross-sell or opportunities to sort of increase how I'm doing with the customer, but to just understand and to be able to ask better questions of my data by bringing data together in a bigger, in a more comprehensive way.
This is number one. Let me just understand this quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue with data analytics is first, you need to have data in a format that you can actually process, which is structured data. So, I mean, you can use PDF documents, but this is not very much structured. And even emails isn't super structured, depending on who is writing. But anyways, then you have this data hygiene stuff where you need to make sure that not only is the data actually factually correct, but also it's not duplicated. It's kind of doesn't contradict each other. And is this something where AI can sort of help you sift through all this data and either categorize it or kind of cluster it or anything like that? Is this something where AI is helpful?
That is absolutely an area where you can use AI to do that. And so it is, I'd say, an area that's still under development. That sort of idea of using machine learning on your data prep itself has been a target for a long time, but is very hard to do. So,
in one sentence, why is it so hard?
Variability of your data sources.
Right.
Right. So if you have 1,000 customers in one database and 10,000 customers in another database and whatever, like AI benefits by volume. The more data you can feed it, the better. And when you have 220 different pricing systems with a customer database under every single one of them, you don't have enough data in one place to be able to do that. And you're not capturing things the same way. And so AI is getting better at that. And that's actually like one of the potential uses of large language models that I'm actually most excited about is the ability to, if you've, again, it's how are you housing all that data, right? And so one of the things I like about Dataiku is that it's sort of system agnostic. So you can be working with Dataiku in all of your different systems, on-premise, in the cloud, whatever. And then I can actually go in and say, okay, you've built 10,000 data products and they're across all these different systems, but I can look at all of them and understand the sort of data prep and data cleansing that you're doing. And so then you can actually take that and say, okay, when you're looking at customer data, what does that look like? And you know, whether it's going to be some sort of SQL under the hood, right, is whatever you're doing this data prep in. SQL is a language and large language models are good at understanding languages, right? And so that's actually one of the really interesting and powerful applications that I see coming from that. We've actually built some POCs on that at Dataiku around sort of automatic data cleansing with an LLM. And it goes back to something you're saying on like, especially all this structuring side. The structuring is important for a lot of the financial metrics and predictive models that we've done in the past. But one of the exciting parts about, you know, the generative AI and the large language models is that ability to use unstructured data far more powerfully than we've ever done before.
You can just like dump all your stuff into large language model and it kind of does like a washing machine and then it gets some sort of cleaned.
There's still smarter ways to dump the data. Some metadata on top of them. There's still things that we can do. I'm here in San Francisco this week and was actually at a big large language model meeting yesterday. And that was actually one of the things that we were talking about a lot was sort of, or the meetup was around some metadata, some context for your data actually can help those language models be much, much more powerful, right? And so, you know, just feeding it in a PDF is one thing, but feeding it a PDF where you've tagged the page numbers helps. Where, so, you know, for an example of that, sort of like, I want to just be able to ask a question of, you know, I've uploaded a bunch of contracts or I've uploaded a bunch of policies, you know, maybe I've got historical information on a customer that we're looking to underwrite. So I feed them all in. And if I ask the questions, it's one thing, you know, for the large language model to say, here was what their loss experience was like. It's a different thing for it to come back and say, here's what their loss experience was like. Here's these claims on page this, this, and this, that now I can go in and A, make sure that it's not like the AI hallucination stuff where the model is building things, but there's still smarter ways.
So it's this tagging, right? It's like these tasks on Amazon. I think they closed it by now, but this crowdsourcing task thing.
Mechanical Turk.
Exactly. It's this Mechanical Turk jobs where you kind of tag and categorize unstructured data in certain ways.
There's also now automatic or assisted labeling tools as well.
Right.
And so, and a great example of those, I mean, we have tools like that, some built into Dataiku, there's some open source ones, but there's a handful of sort of vendors specifically building products for that, where say I have 70,000 documents that I need, you have to start somewhere. I can have someone go do a few hundred, but then you can use these tools to do assisted labeling, where then it can take the seed of a handful of those, and then AI will go and tag all of those. And then you can feed that into a large language model. So now we're getting into some more complicated architectures of models feeding into models.
Multi-level.
but that is genuinely like where these sorts of things go is that, you know, you want to have this. And of course, you have to be then very careful around sort of like the noise introduced into the system at every step.
Right.
And make sure that you're controlling for that effectively. But that's sort of the Mechanical Turk. I'm going to pay, you know, somebody 10 cents an hour to go and do to label all of these is problematic on many levels. But if I have some of my SMEs do some and then have a model with, then you can do, you know, it's called RLHF, reinforcement learning with human feedback, where you have the model go in and do some, and then you have somebody check those and you have it do again. You can improve the model quite a bit and have this sort of like virtuous cycle of now you've got good labeled data or metadata on that, those PDFs or whatever it is. And then you could go feed those into an LLM for that sort of question and answer type of stuff.
So just like when you want to write a LinkedIn post today, and you go to ChatGPT and then suggest me 20 suggestions on how to kind of build modern digital services, it gives you like a list of 20 random things it found on the internet.
Yeah.
It sort of, it scales your own productivity. Mm-hmm. This is kind of always the key thing, at least as of today, where you can take a data set and you just do, like, as you said, like you do 10% of it, and then you scale this up to 100% of the entire data set. And then you feed this into this large language model, which then does kind of more categorization and kind of understanding of this thing. And then you can ask these questions again, and then the large language model goes through its sort of model and kind of calculates based on your query or prompt. The answers. This is sort of the always the logic. So it kind of 10x's your productivity.
And I think it's not even just a productivity tool. It can make you more effective as well, right? Like it can be better at getting the best answer out as well. So not only are you faster, but you're producing a better result at the end.
You got to check it though, right?
I mean, you have to check it. Oh, yes.
Faster is always in the eye of the beholder, right? You got to go through all these 20 things that ChatGPT created and you got to throw out all the bullshit, obviously wrong, superficial things. And then you end up with a list of, I don't know, 10 plus 10 or 10 plus 5, which you might have not thought of before, which are still correct, right?
Yes. And I think that part, you know, my example for that was always when I was working as a meteorologist, right? Because weather models are incredibly complex and very, very sophisticated. But our job as forecasters was to understand the output of that model, take in the other data that was feeding the model, but that we also had access to, and then refine it, understand what's working, understand what's not, and then create a forecast out of that. And as good as those weather models get, there's never, or at least for a long, long time, from having forecasters not being part of that process. And there are certain things that you can just automate, and that's fine. But for these complicated things and these complex sort of like human-based things, yes, the AI tools will make us better at those jobs. But in many of those, it's hard to see the AI tools taking those jobs over because there's so much need for that sort of that critical thinking that a human brings to the table.
We haven't talked about your software, your solution, actually. Maybe we should touch on this quote briefly, how this all ties into this. So you guys are enabling all of what we've just talked about in your, is it the software suite or how would you call it?
A platform.
A platform, of course. I thought it was an ecosystem, but platform is also great.
Yeah, right. Well, you have to make it as big as possible so that you can create the market. So our platform enables you to do sort of like the whole variety of analytics. So the way I really typically describe it, you know, as quickly as possible is it allows all of your people to access all of your data and use any analytical technique. It has coding capabilities. It's a lot. It's a big platform. Okay. It really is. But it has coding and non-coding capabilities. So your data scientists and your engineers can go in and use languages like they're used to, but it also has graphical interfaces where somebody can, who's used Excel or Alteryx or something like that, can create their analytics without having to know how to code.
So you guys are connecting to the existing data warehouse and you are kind of pulling out the data and then you're visualizing it, or kind of, not visualizing is kind of too simple, but sort of feeding this back to the user in forms of visual graphs plus AI and kind of all these type of.
And so you get that sort of, so that we sit on top of your data, wherever, in cloud, on-prem, whatever that is. And we just pull like a little bit of the data in as a sample and for the user to work with, so that as they're making changes to the data, it's sort of like Excel. You see the change happen in a tabular format, but then it's only happening to a little bit of a sample. And then you go and you run it back in the data where, you know, in the database. And so we're sort of not moving a ton of data around, the data sitting in the database, but you can do that for data that's in your cloud, in your SQL databases. You can upload CSVs and Excel files and things like that. So it sort of allows you to be fair, right? If you're still running on like a 1970s IBM mainframe and you're trying to pull it out of the AS400, okay, it's probably going to take a little steps to get to Dataiku, can't go straight to it.
but it's possible.
I've lived it, right? So it's not a hypothetical to say it, to put it that way. But so maybe not all of your data, but the vast majority of your data,
right?
Structured and unstructured, right? So you can just go to, you know, a blob store that's got a whole bunch of PDFs in it, and you can pull that data out as well. And it allows you, we support it, you know, that sort of full spectrum of analytics, because sometimes all you need to do is clean the data and then rank it,
right?
And, you know, just being able to say customer 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is all I needed to do. Great. But now I want to predict who's going to be number one in 6 months or a year from now. And I can move into using data science and models or building dashboards or now integrate LLMs. And
so it's like a window into your data.
Yeah, it's a great way to put it.
You see, this is, so the way I was just picturing it in my mind is, back then we had these huge computers where you had actually terminals that were sort of, not I mean, depending on how you call this, but smaller computers with keyboard and screen where you could connect to this large, huge computer. And then you had like, I don't know, 10 minutes to work on this because you kind of booked like 10 minutes of CPU time or so.
Yeah.
And this is sort of the same for data right now. So you can sort of log onto this system, which is obviously running in the cloud, I believe. And you can see through your browser, I believe.
Yep.
And this opens up a window into the data of the company, depending on your skill level. If you're happy writing SQL queries, you can do that.
Yep.
If you're just like drag and dropping stuff, that's also fine. If you're just asking questions like large language model, that's also fine.
Yes.
Awesome.
Yes.
I got it.
The windows are great. I often describe it sort of as a workbench or that sort of like one pane of glass.
Yeah.
Where you can access all your data and answer.
Yeah, but you're questions. Welcome for this window to the data.
I'll reuse that. Thank you.
Nice. All right, cool. Maybe let's just summarize what we've talked about. So for someone that has listened to this, to take away the key things. So we've started with this other company that was good at transforming their own business to a sort of somewhat data first company within 18 months or so. And they did this because, you got to help me, which is like this
collaboration.
It was
and business need, business driven need, collaboration.
Exactly. Mindset.
The mindset. Right,
projects, sort of like process instead of projects and products.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then that they were explicit on how they're going to capture the ROI, so that after they'd made the investment, when the board comes and says, "How did you spend this money?" You said, "Oh, this is what we got for it." I think those were three huge drivers for their success, for sure.
Right. And then we talked about privacy and how do we balance privacy by starting with, how do you do that? Like talking to privacy teams early on, right?
So it was start from the business problem you're trying to solve.
Yeah.
Identify the potential data that could be used, and then just go through and understand what data is problematic, how are we going to use it, what ways we can use it, and what ways we can't use it.
And then we had AI, how can AI help? And this is sort of by scaling your own productivity, by kind of scaling, you're tagging 10% of the data and it kind of scales it up to 100% and then feeds this into a large language model. And then you can sort of ask this general questions and it tries to answer them in some way or not.
Yep. In most cases, AI is going to help you do what you already do today better and faster.
Nice. What are you most excited about when it comes to your platform in the next 12 months? Any awesome features you guys are launching or anything you're looking forward to?
And so one thing that I actually do think is pretty interesting is that we're actually taking some of the generative AI capabilities and building them into the tool. So now not only can you do sort of the coding and write your SQL or your Python or do the drag and drop, but actually do prompt-based engineering of saying, hey, take this data set and clean it up, parse my dates, combine these rows and do whatever, and we'll actually automatically create some of the things. Doing the same for charts, doing the same for full projects. So some of that, when we were talking about using machine learning for data prep, we're building some of those functionalities into it. And as a longtime terrible coder, I'm a pretty good mathematician and data scientist. I hate coding and I always have and I always will. Anything that makes that part of the process easier for me, I'm excited about.
Cool. Thanks, Connor. That was a great talk.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Das war der Digital Insurance Podcast. Folge uns bei LinkedIn und hinterlasse uns eine Bewertung in deiner Podcast-App. Vielen Dank, dein Jonas.